shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Our Father, again we thank Thee for this opportunity to gather together in Christian fellowship, Thy children coming together to study Thy Word and learn the things Thou hast provided for our guidance in these closing days of the age. We pray Thou wilt be with us now. Put Thy Spirit upon us. Open our minds and give us understanding. In Jesus' name, amen. Trying to keep one jump ahead of you people is a problem because some of you have been with me for a good 10 years. I try not to keep saying the same thing over and over again. And keeping ahead of you is a problem. But I ran into something a little different that I think it's time we brushed up on. And I want to talk to you tonight on what is not a strictly religious subject, but it fits definitely within the pattern of our religion. And that's on a matter of race. I want to talk to you about the Celtic and Teutonic peoples. Now, it's been common for everybody to assume, and I did myself because everybody else was doing it, to assume that the Celtic peoples are part of the Israel group. And when I got to studying it historically, I ran into some things that it seemed to me needed to be brought out and brushed up on. Now, by way of starting off, you remember that the people of the northerly kingdom of Israel were not taken into the Assyrian captivity until the period from 740 to 721 BC. And they didn't start their move out of Asia Minor into Europe until a bit over a century later. So, you have them, a little before 500 BC, all of them on the march for Europe. Now, we've traced them long before this. We've traced them in their march through the Caucasus Mountains, around the east end of the Black Sea, on up the Danube Valley, across into northern and western Europe, most of them. So, you can say that they were getting into Europe, probably some few of them in the middle 500s, and the rest of them by about 500 B.C. That's the people of Israel. Now, as you presumably know, the white race are divided into three classifications or sub-races. There is the Nordic, a people generally fairly tall, well-built, many of them blonde, most of them blue-eyed, and all of them with a relatively long skull. The skull is classified by the proportion of the width to the length of the skull. If the width of the skull is 75% or less of its length. That is classified as long-headed dolichocephaly. If it is 80% or more of the length, it is classified as broad-headed brachycephaly. So, the characteristic of the Nordic group are the long skull, the relatively great pipe compared to some of the others, comparatively slim build, and fair complexion. Then you have an intermediate group, the Alpine. They are usually shorter than the Nordics, of a stocky build, strong, muscular, but thicker build, and in general have the round head, the broad head. Then you have the southernmost group, the Mediterranean. Slender of build, generally shorter than either of the other two, and of darker complexion. They are also long-headed. These characteristics will enable you to tell, as a general rule, whether a person is of which particular one of these three sub-races, or if, as so many of us are, there is a mixture, you can tell which of these sub-races are in the mixture by their characteristics the individual possesses. Now, the people of Israel were an Aryan or Nordic type people. We have that from very good evidence. A few skeletons found by archaeologists that show the typical Nordic skull formation, but also the ancient monuments. The kings of the various ancient empires were very vain about their military conquests, and they liked to leave carved stone monuments telling how they captured this city and massacred 50% of its inhabitants and enslaved the rest and so on. And as a general rule, besides the inscription, there would be a panel of illustration also which would show captives of that particular nation, possibly in the process of getting their heads lopped off, but anyway, captives. The pharaohs of Egypt, the kings of Babylon and Assyria and Persia, all left monuments of this sort. And one thing is perfectly consistent about them all. Wherever they showed Israelite captives, they always showed a straight-nosed, typically Anglo-Saxon face. But whenever they showed Canaanite peoples, those that the Israelites lived among and were told to exterminate, or where they showed the Assyrians themselves, they showed typical hook-nosed Jews, unmistakably. So, we start out with the basic proposition that the Israelites, when they went on their long march, were a Nordic people. The classification Aryan is used sometimes from a linguistic point of view, because the Aryan peoples have a language that all originated with the Sanskrit. There are many words in our modern European languages that obviously are derived from Sanskrit. Now we find when we get into Europe in the time when the people of Israel were marching in there, we find that Europe already was partly occupied, but other than the southern portion of it, not very densely. As I say, they came around the easterly end of the Black Sea and crossed through southwestern Russia, the Crimea, went along the north shore of the Black Sea to the mouth of the Danube, and the bulk of them started up the Danube River. That was the central axis of their migration. They moved out, of course, to right and left of that as well. Now, the people of Israel, as I say, wouldn't be getting in there earlier than about 500 B.C. But the Greek historians write of other people that were found there before the Israelites had a chance to get there. One of these races are the Celtic. That's from the Greek word Keltoi, which is the Greek form of a Celtic word meaning heroes. They were suitably modest in describing themselves. Now, the Celtic people were of the Alpine race, fairly tall, but not averaging as tall as the Nordic. Some of them blonde, most of them brunette, chunky build, and fairly broad skull. Now, the first trace of them found in Europe is late in the second millennium B.C. In other words, just about the time that the Israelites were moving out of Egypt into Palestine, you had evidence that the Celts were either already in or moving into Europe at that time. There were a lot of them, and they covered a big area. They came in first, of course, through Eastern Europe and Germany, South Germany. There were at least 150 tribes speaking Celtic languages. Now, this was before the Latins appeared on the scene. You remember the city of Rome is said to have been founded in 753 B.C. And here were the Celts dominating all southern and southwestern Europe at least 600 years before that time. But they didn't get down into middle or southern Italy. They were up in the valley of the Po, up around the headwaters of the Adriatic, through Switzerland, southern France, Spain, Portugal. So here were these Celtic people, too early to be originally part of the Israel migration. Well, sometime before 1000 B.C., part of these Celtic peoples, the Goidels, or Gaels, crossed the English Channel and occupied Ireland, Britain, and the nearby islands around them. You had a high civilization there, so it shows that these were no mere wandering savages. Early Ireland had a very high civilization. Irish and British gold and enameled jewelry was extraordinarily beautiful even by today's standards. Their workmanship would bring high prices today. It was that beautifully done. And Irish and British swords were highly valued all over the Mediterranean countries, clear back to Asia Minor. So they were metal workers of a high order. You'll remember that from Cornwall they got the tin, which combined with copper made bronze. And this was still in the Bronze Age. Now, among the Britons, possibly not this early, but soon thereafter, you have their Druidic religion. That was a religion of a relatively high order. They didn't have the bestial features of the Western Asiatic or Greek or Roman paganism. And they did have a very high education. The Druids, the priests, had to graduate from a 20-year course of education in the Druidic universities, and there were 40 of these Druidic universities in the British Isles. They studied all the known sciences, including astronomy, mathematics, physics, what little was known of chemistry, and philosophy. They were very well educated people when they came out of that, and they were very well fitted to be effectively the government. Then another Celtic tribe called the Bretons, they moved out of France, Gaul as it was called then, and occupied Britain somewhere in the 5th or 4th centuries B.C. They were part of this Celtic migration. Now you remember the Romans came in under Julius Caesar. First, I think, in 49 B.C. And they sent some of their best generals there to conquer the British. Well, now, they never got into Ireland. They never got into Scotland. England was the only part they conquered, and it was these Britons who were conquered by the Romans. There's been quite a bit of change among the people in the British Isles. Those who settled in Ireland were called Scots. And Ireland had the early name of Scotia, the land of the Scots. Later, when a settlement of the Scots was made in what today we call Scotland, that was called Scotia Minor. Now, the original people in Scotland were the Picts. P-I-C-T, Picts. They're a people we don't know much about. They were there when the first trace of them is found. We know little about them. They were a short, stocky, dark people, and they were tough. The Romans came in there. Now, the Romans lacked a good many good qualities. But one thing they did have was excellent military organization and training. They knew how to conduct warfare. So they came in with the idea that nobody could stand up before Roman legions. And as I say, they overcame the Britons, and then they moved on up into the narrow waste of the island, and began bumping into the Picts of Scotland. Well, they got themselves whipped very thoroughly. In fact, they reached the point where they had to build big stone walls, two of them, across the island of Britain at the narrow waistline, in order to have a defensible line where they could keep the Picts back. So the proud Romans took a beating there. Why was it that they conquered the Britons? Well, something that's been typical of the Gaels from the beginning and still is. is the fact that they aren't able to get together and cooperate for their own good. It's proverbial how if an Irishman doesn't have anybody else to fight with, he'll fight with his fellow Irishman. And it was that way to begin with. Any good history of early Ireland will show you that the different Irish tribes were constantly at war with each other, and they couldn't forget these differences, any of these Celts, when they were up against the Romans. The same was true of the Celtic people in what today is France, then was called Gaul. They might, for the purposes of one battle, combine against the Romans and sometimes gain a victory. Then, in between battles, they had to resume their feuds among their own sub-tribes, and they wasted all their strength killing each other off instead of killing the Romans. So for that reason, the Britons were finally overwhelmed and conquered. The evenly Romans, who never willingly wrote anything good about any other people, had to grudgingly admit their admiration for the Britons. The Britons believed in immortality of the soul, resurrection. So they weren't afraid of death, and they fought with a ferocity that the Romans couldn't understand. But nevertheless, as I say, because they were fighting against each other, and one tribe would betray another to the Romans in order to satisfy an ancient grudge, until finally they were all conquered. Now, considering Scotland, the language of these Picts is unknown. We have no record of anything in their language. Well, finally, when the Romans were under attack by the so-called barbarians, the Teutonic tribes, the Germans, the Romans first hired some of these so-called barbarians as mercenary troops to help defend Rome. But the Teutons weren't too interested. They saw the Romans were by this time a people who had degenerated where they weren't willing to put up much of a fight themselves. And the Teutonic tribes finally said, why should we fight for a people who won't fight for themselves? In 408 AD, the last of the Roman legions were pulled out of Britain and brought back to Rome in the hope of defending it against the Visigoths, who were definitely an Israelite people. It was too late. The Romans paid the Visigoths a huge bribe, tribute, to spare the city of Rome in 408 AD. But by 410, the Visigoths had spent the money, so they came in and took Rome and looted it anyway. Now, the Goths were definitely an Israel people. You had the two different Gothic tribes, the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths. Visigoths were West Goths. Ostrogoths were East Goths. You can pick them up when they were still in Scythia under their name of Goths. So tracing them is simple enough. They were among the last of the Israel peoples to make their march, and they were being pushed westward ahead of the advance of the Huns under Attila. So the Visigoths first marched through, as I say, in 410. They took and looted the city of Rome. Well, the Romans were smart. They'd already been looted in the 300s by the Vandals, who were another Germanic tribe, Israel. and the Vandals had moved on into Spain. So the Romans said to the Visigoths, now you can see there isn't much left here for you to swipe, but we've got some nice country over here in Spain, and why don't you go over there and settle? Well, the Visigoths didn't see any particular point in staying in a semi-impoverished country as Italy was then. So they moved out across the Alps and into southern France, Gaul as it was called then, and settled there. The Ostrogoths, the East Goths, held out a little bit longer against the pressure from the east, from the invading Mongols, and then they too had to come west. Some of them went north, clear up to the shores of the Baltic, because the Greek historians mention a Gothic tribe on the southeastern shore of the Baltic Sea. But others went west, across the north end of the Adriatic Sea, down into Italy. They also took and looted Rome, and they set up in North Italy, up in the Po Valley, a Gothic kingdom, which, however, didn't last very long as an independent political entity. Nevertheless, the people were there, and while their political independence was overthrown after about 25 years, there is today a great deal of difference racially to be found between the extreme southern Italians and the extreme northern Italians. Whereas in central Italy, you have a mixture, some Celts, some Nordics, some Mediterraneans. So, the Romans had pulled out all their troops from Britain. Now, while the Romans were there, they were tough enough fighters. They pretty well protected the island from attack by anybody else. But with the Romans gone, there came another invasion starting. It wasn't a full-scale invasion at the start. It was just looting raids. And that was the Danish and Norse Vikings began harrying the coasts of Britain. Well, for that matter, not only Britain, but Scotland and Ireland. These were probably the first people of the Israel migration to reach the shores of the Baltic. And they had settled in northwestern Germany and across the Baltic from the Scandinavian peninsula. The Scandinavian peninsula is very mountainous along its western side, Norway. If a Norwegian's foot slips, he winds up in a fjord a couple of thousand feet down below. There's very little farming, there's very little land in which there is anything but rock to farm. And so they were very early forced to become a seafaring people. And as they multiplied, they needed more territory. Now, the Danes, again, were in a little area, a little peninsula, and again, as they became more numerous, they wanted more elbow room. Both were seafaring people. Now, the Swedes, along the easterly side of the Scandinavian peninsula, didn't become, to any great extent, a seafaring people. And to what extent they did, they were facing the Baltic Sea. They were at the westerly end of it. And their expeditions were mostly along the Baltic shores. But to the British Isles came the Norse and Danish Vikings. They didn't limit their expeditions there. They harried the shores of France. Oh, on three different occasions, they captured and looted the city of Paris. And they made such a nuisance of themselves that in 911, I believe it was, one of the kings of France gave the coastal province of Normandy to a Viking chieftain, Rollo, on condition he'd bring his people there and settle and be a buffer against further raids. So, along the coast, Normandy and Brittany, you had Norse and Danish Vikings settled there. Pure Nordic people. Not related at all to the Latin French. Actually, Viking ships went down through the Straits of Gibraltar into the Mediterranean. They at one time conquered and for about a century ruled the island of Sicily. And Viking ships even showed up in the harbor of Sicily, of Byzantium, Constantinople. Well, the Britons, not basically a military people like the Roman, and not having had much practice in it because the Romans didn't want them to become a well-trained military people, they weren't equal to defending themselves against these raids from the Vikings. So they called upon some Germanic people, the Jutes, the Angles, and the Saxons, to come help them defend against the Norse raids. The Jutes, Angles, and Saxons were in northwestern Germany, right around Denmark. They also were apparently a seafaring people because they didn't try to walk. They came in their ships. But remember, in those days, it was a case of everybody helping himself. And when you called in somebody else as allies to help you defend against one enemy, you probably found that they had decided they'd conquer you themselves. So that is what happened when the Jutes, Angles, and Saxons came over 429 AD, if I remember the date correctly. They came over and settled along the Channel coast of England. It was hoped that they would simply take a thin little stretch along the Channel coast, but they weren't limiting themselves. And they took over from the Britons a great deal of territory. The Britons were, well, you might say those that weren't exterminated in the warfare, were driven back into Wales and Cornwall, extreme southwestern Britain. So, remember now, you had at this time an all-Celtic Ireland, the Scots. You had an all-Celtic Cornwall and Wales. You had the rest of England being mostly, by now, Nordic, Jute, Angle, Saxon, and they weren't able to stop these Vikings. You had continuing raids, with some of them landing, capturing a place, and settling there. So that one Irish history that I read said there was hardly a village in Ireland that didn't have its Viking settlers there. The same became true of Scotland. So now you have the racial pattern gradually building up. We have been accustomed to thinking of England as the all Israelite, all Nordic country, but in truth it was not. because you had the considerable Celtic element which got there before any of the people of Britain did. And there has been that intermixture. The Saxons, as I say, they ran the Britons out of southern England. They tried their hand against the Picts of Scotland and weren't able to get anywhere with them. Now, meantime, around 600 or so A.D., you had a considerable Irish-Scot migration into Scotland, and it was accomplished peaceably. There doesn't seem to have been a great deal of fighting with the Picts to get in there. Somehow, they got along with each other better than you expected anybody to do in that period of time. And you remember that the Stone of Scone, the Coronation Stone, had been in Ireland all this time, where the Irish kings were crowned sitting upon that stone. But when the King of Scotland, Fergus, asked the stone to be brought over there for him to be crowned on it, it was sent with no argument because they recognized that he was a Scot, along with the Irish so-called Scots, and the stone was sent there and remained there until the English finally captured it. The Picts were converted to Christianity. Their king of the Picts, Angus MacFergus, ruled over Scotland from 731 to 751 A.D. But soon after that, the Picts somehow just disappeared. They were absorbed in the other population. And by the mid-800s, Kenneth MacAlpine ruled as King of the Scots. On the continent of Europe, you have the Teutonic peoples, pure Nordic, in Germany. And you have the Celtic peoples in Gaul, modern France. In 451 A.D., a combined army of Romans and Visigoths defeated Attila the Hun in Gaul, and shortly after that, Attila died, and his invasion force broke up and went back to Mongolia. Now, the Franks were a Teutonic people from Germany who moved west and southwest into Gaul. They entered Gaul, and in 486 AD, they drove out the last Roman forces from Gaul. So Rome had lost that entirely. The Franks finally built up a great empire under Charlemagne. He had a good deal of Germany, all of Gaul, some south of the Pyrenees into Spain and Portugal, and all of Italy. He built up a revived Roman Empire. With the breakup of the original Roman power, there was nothing to keep order, and everything was anarchy and chaos. And the people of Italy, fighting among themselves just like these Celtic Gauls, were being fed up with the anarchy. And so when a strong king came along, they saw the benefit of it. Now, the Caesars were gone, but the Pope, however, was succeeding to the power of the Caesars. And when Charlemagne came to power and got power over Italy, the Pope thought that this was a good chance to consolidate his power. And he crowned Charlemagne as Emperor of the Romans, and claimed from then on that kings got their crowns only by gift from him. That was where their authority came from. Well, Charlemagne's dynasty lasted about 80 years. Not from any degeneration of his people, but from degeneration of his own family. His descendants were weak and incompetent kings. It finally broke up. Now Charlemagne, that's the French form of Carolus Magnus, Charles the Great. So he was the great. But the last two kings of his dynasty were known as Charles the Bald and Charles the Fat. The only things they were noted for. I spoke of this kingdom of the Franks being established in Gaul, and it was Teutonic. Now, it finally broke up into a West Frankish kingdom and an Easterly one. The West, it was already, majority of its people were Celtic. And remember, the Celts had been under the Romans for a considerable time as the Roman province of Gaul. And so the Western Frankish kingdom adopted a Latinized language and a Latinized custom and became modern France. The Easterly Frankish kingdom kept their Teutonic language and in substance became modern Germany. Now, as to the Teutonic peoples, the name originally in Gothic was Theuden. It was Theod in Anglo-Saxon. It was Deutisch in Old High German, Deutsch in Modern German, and Teutonis in Latin. From the Latin Teutonis, we get our Teuton in English. Now, the original form of it meant the folk. The people. Incidentally, the other name given to those people, German, in English, is also from the Latin. Now, all the Teutonic languages, German, Danish, Norse, Swedish, Icelandic, Anglo-Saxon, and from the Anglo-Saxon English, are derived from the Sanskrit. They're Aryan languages and show a common racial source. Incidentally, the Anglo-Saxon language was substantially the same as Low German. The Teutonic peoples, as I say, were originally Nordic. Tall, long-headed, mostly fair, not all of them though, even in ancient times. Now, in more recent times, there's been a considerable Alpine racial element introduced into Easterly Germany. The Nordic Teutonic stock drove westwardly, part of them into the British Isles, part of them into Gaul, and well, they simply grew out of Eastern Germany and were replaced by, probably related to the Celts, a Nordic people. So you will find in modern Germany two different racial types. It's interesting to note their religion. You all know from your school days something about the Greek and Latin pagan religions. Their gods were sort of caricatures of all the worst vices of humanity. They didn't have the good qualities, but they had all the bad qualities of the people who were their worshippers. But even as pagans, these Teutonic people had a relatively wholesome religion. True, they did start out with a number of gods who were deified heroes. Odin, for example, there's the German form of it, Wotan, but it's the same person, was actually a Scythian chieftain who led his tribe from Scythia across Europe to the shores of the Baltic Sea, and actually his tomb is still known in Sweden. But he became deified by their poets. So their pagan gods, Odin, Thor, so on, basically they were a decent moral set. They reflected their times. They were rough brawlers, always ready for a fight, which was the way their people were at that time. But they didn't have the vices and the viciousness of the Greco-Roman pagan gods. And then they had a belief in the inevitability of fate. There was coming the time, Ragnarok, the end of the world, when even the gods themselves must die. But after that, there was a supreme god, the All-Father, who was going to restore a new earth and a new heaven. So somehow or other, way back in their pagan days, they had traces of what we have in Christianity. In southerly Europe, you had, of course, the power of the Roman Catholic Church rising to its height. Here were people who were accustomed to the Roman Imperium. Everybody on a semi-slave level, ruled by a strong government. And that's the way the Pope intended to keep them. But that sort of thing didn't go over with these Teutonic people. In fact, when some of these Teutonic peoples were captured in one of their raids on Paris and brought before the French king, he asked them, "Well, who's your leader? Who's your master?" They said, "We have no master. We are all equals." And that was their spirit. And even in religion, they weren't about to have a master. Now, you've had one difficulty here, and that is that Germany was always too narrow territorially for its people. As they increased in number, they didn't have room to expand in their own all-contiguous territory. So what they did, they served as feeders for other areas. You had some of them going out to the British Isles and building up the blood of the ancient Briton, the Anglo-Saxon, Norse, Danish. You have some of them going into Gaul. The present-day French are predominantly Celtic, but with a strong Teutonic minority element too. And then, of course, in more recent times, you've had big German migrations to the United States, but they're not making it a German territory in any of these things. It's kept Germany restricted in its power and place in the civilization. This Frankish kingdom that I mentioned was the one remaining element of strength that continued after the breakdown of the old Roman Empire. You had the renewed Roman Empire under Charlemagne. You had the later so-called Holy Roman Empire, always with the Germanic king. That continued down until 1806. Incidentally, among the things they did, not only did they turn back the Huns under Attila, but the Frankish kingdom under Charles Martel repelled the Moors at Tours in Gaul in 732 A.D. Now the Moors, beginning in 711 A.D., had invaded Spain and conquered Spain pretty rapidly. They pushed across the Pyrenees into France in 732, and if it hadn't been for the victory of the Franks under Charles Martel, why, all Europe would have come under the blight of the Moorish rule. Spain, you remember, got nowhere under the Moors, and in fact, nowhere ever since. What we can say, to sum this thing up, is this. The Teutonic peoples are definitely of pure Israel stock. The Celtic peoples were originally not, but by admixture with the Teutonic peoples. The result are the descendants, the only descendants there are in those countries, of the ancient Israel. So while they didn't start out as literally Israel, now they were Adamic, they were our cousins, not our brothers. Anybody have any questions?
I'm going to ask if these Celtic gods you're talking about ever more mystical compared to the Roman and Greek gods being mythological, aren't they?
Well, that is very true, yes. The Roman and Greek gods, their religion was one of their poetic mythology more than anything else. As far as going into real religion is concerned, they didn't have any.
Would you say that these Teuton people you're talking about were rootin' Teuton people?
Yes, I guess you could. The Nordic peoples did have always, as far as we picked them up, that mystic element in them, their desire to go into the philosophical side of religion. They have had from the beginning a tendency toward, well, fatalism isn't the word, but predestination. That feeling that things were predestined, it came out in the paganized form. Their belief that fate was unchangeable and Ragnarok, the destruction of the world, was bound to happen, and even the gods were powerless to prevent it. So you found that the religions featuring predestination always took a ready hold among the Teutonic peoples.
Were Charlemagne and Charles Martel Celtic?
Charles Martel would have been Celtic. Yes, Charles Martel was Celtic. Charlemagne, however, see, he was crowned in 800 A.D. as king of the new Roman Empire, so he was in the Teutonic period.
Virgil, couldn't you make a comparison with one that occurs to me? The acceptance of the two sons of Joseph's wife, Asenath, the taking of Manasseh, they were not descendants of Israel, native Israel, but they were acceptable in the family because they were pure white, unpolluted, no racial line descendants of them.
You have an excellent point there. In Egypt, Joseph, of course, couldn't marry anyone from the old original Syrian family stock. They weren't there. But he did have available Asenath, the daughter of the priest of On, or Heliopolis, a remainder from the old Hyksos invasion, and they were of, while they weren't, well, let's put it this way. Imagine a pyramid coming to a sharp point at the top. That sharp point is Adam. And the pyramid widening out below him are his descendants. Each successive generation below widening out more and more as it becomes more numerous. Those are the Adamic people. Right down the exact center runs a single thread, one person out of each generation, till you get down to Jacob, Israel himself, and then his descendants, the Israelites, begin widening out in a smaller pyramid inside the big pyramid. Now, he did have to stay within the larger pyramid, the Adamic, to pick his wife, even though he couldn't stay within the smaller one. But his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, were given an especially favored position among the 12 sons of Israel.
So likewise, the Celtic people are acceptable and part of the same great thing.
Yes. There's a very close blood relation there, although it's not identically the same.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.